Dave keeps a collection of smudged notes, handwritten on cardboard, taped to the inside of the front door of his record store, The Vinyl Cafe. Back in 15 minutes. I'm at Kenny Wong's. That's Wong's Scottish Meat Pies. 5 stores along the street. Gone to the bank. He's been using some of those notes for years, and many of them are so smudged that Dave's the only one who can read them anymore. The small pleasure of going home at noon is one of the things that owning a secondhand record store allows you. When you choose to paddle in the backwaters, people don't get bent out of shape when you pull to shore from time to time. Dave closes his store and goes home to eat lunch a couple of days a week. It's the only time he can count on being home alone, which being the father of a teenage daughter is a small pleasure that he's thankful for. He enjoys getting to the mail before anyone else, sorting it out while he eats a sandwich or a bowl of soup. Dave came home to do just that in the middle of last week, and he found an envelope of the kind he's always hopeful of finding, the sort of letter that's the reason he bothers to check the mail. It was an ivory envelope of fine quality, and best of all, it was addressed to him in a handwriting that he did not recognize. There was no return address. Now, a handwritten personal letter is not the sort of thing that you see every day of the week. It gave Dave pleasure just to hold it. The author had used a fountain pen. It was a touch that implied intimacy, a kind of extravagance, something an old girlfriend might do. Dave carried a sandwich to the table, and he ate half and wiped his hands carefully, and then he picked up the letter, and he slid it open. Dear Dave, the salutation had been handwritten in the same ink as the address on the envelope, but the body of the letter had been typed. Printed, actually. It appeared to be a form letter. There's no disappointment as painful as the fall that comes with great expectations. Dear Dave, this letter began 5 years ago in a small village on the coast of Turkey. It was written by a woman who lost her husband and children in a horrible traffic accident. Since she wrote this letter, it has traveled around the world 5 times, and it has brought fortune and good luck to those who have received it and not broken the chain. A lady in Brazil received a copy of this letter in 1997, and she sent copies to relatives and friends. Within a week, she won a lottery and now lives in a large house on Miami Beach, surrounded by a fence. A dairy farmer in Britain threw his copy out, and England was eliminated from the World Cup. You must make 5 copies of this letter and mail it to your friends or neighbors within 48 hours. You don't have to send them anything else. Don't tempt fate. Continue the chain. The letter was unsigned. Dave stared at the envelope. The handwriting looked vaguely familiar, but he couldn't place it. He got up from the table, he carried it across the kitchen, and he dropped it in the garbage can. He washed the dishes, and he went back to work. But the thought of the letter tugged at him all afternoon. Dave knew perfectly well that making 5 copies and sending them to his friends wasn't going to bring him good luck. It was the bad luck he was worried about. England had, after all, been eliminated from the World Cup. That night he pulled the letter out of the kitchen garbage and he flattened it and he folded it and he stuck it in the pocket of his pants. Dave went to bed feeling better, so good in fact that he completely forgot about the letter. Until he found it a week later when he reached into his back pocket looking for his wallet. Dear Dave, don't tempt fate. Continue the chain. It was the same frustratingly familiar handwriting, but his 48 hours of grace were up. He had broken the chain. There would be no letters from him. The urge to pass the letter on was a defensive urge, an evasive action. Dave knows he's never going to win a lottery and live on Miami Beach, and he's comfortable with that, with the knowledge that he is not a winner. But he is also just as determined not to be a loser. Dave was on his way to work when he found that letter in his pocket, and it was with some anxiety that he looked around to see if anyone was watching, and then walked to the corner and dropped it into a garbage can for the second time by the newspaper box. And as he did it, Dave sighed, a sigh of resignation, followed by a long, deeper in-breath, which is, as far as he can remember, the moment he inhaled something. Something that wasn't air. Something bigger than air. Something big enough to drive every thought out of his mind and send him reeling across the sidewalk, coughing, tearing, sputtering, pedestrians gaping at him as if he were having a heart attack. Surely not now, he thought. Not even 50. Dave tried to work out what had happened. The last thing he remembered, he had thrown the letter out into the garbage can on the corner, and he looked over at the metal container, at the garbage spilling over the top, at the flies buzzing around. I just swallowed a fly, he thought. And his hand flew up to his chest involuntarily, and he touched himself, and then he took a few tentative steps away from the garbage can, and everything seemed to be working all right. His legs were working, and he coughed gently, and he took a few more steps, and then he shrugged, and he began to sing softly to himself. I know an old lady who swallowed a fly. Well, I don't know why she swallowed the fly. I guess she'll... And he stopped dead. And as he stood on the sidewalk halfway between Kenny Wong's restaurant and his record store, the awful possibility hit him like a sledgehammer in the stomach. Maybe he didn't swallow the fly. Maybe he inhaled it. Maybe the fly wasn't in his stomach, where it would drown and be eaten by stomach acid and disposed of in the most fitting of all possible fly burials. Maybe the fly was in his lungs, where there was oxygen, where it could presumably live and lay eggs. And the notion of having a lung full of flies horrified Dave. And Dave didn't want to die, especially a trivial death, unexpectedly on his way to work, after a brief struggle with a chain letter. He coughed and went into his store. And pretty soon he knew with certainty the fly was in his lungs. He could feel it. It was a weird sort of buzzing sensation. A tickle. It was less than a cough, but it was undoubtedly there. It wasn't normal. By 3 o'clock, Dave had worked himself into a complete lather. Maybe it was a fly that came into the country in a shipment of exotic fruit. A fly that carried an obscure disease that only a few genetic types in the whole world were susceptible to, and Dave was one of those people. And they'd never diagnose that. He'd get a fever and go into a coma, and then after a long and valiant fight in the hospital, the fever would suddenly break, and he would snap out of the coma, but he'd be speaking in a foreign language that no one could understand. Everyone would think he'd gone crazy until an elderly Egyptian orderly recognized the language as ancient Sumerian. It was 6 o'clock. It was time to close the store. Dave wasn't sure if he should go home or straight to the hospital. He went home, locked himself in the bathroom, and he took his temperature. 99.2. In that gray zone where you don't know which way it's heading. Whenever Dave starts to really get into a potential disease, he likes to do Tai Chi. He only knows a couple of Tai Chi movements, which he repeats over and over, but he feels they center him. So before dinner, he went into the backyard and he started to do Tai Chi. Now, Morley's been around long enough to know what's going on when this happens. So when Morley saw Dave in the backyard awkwardly spinning and stretching and bending, she opened the window and she called out, "Dave," she said, "there's no such disease." Well, what did she know? Dave knew he was going to die. The best he could hope for was that he might become a world-famous medical case and attract someone who could help him. Maybe along with a Sumerian, he'd develop the ability to solve complex mathematical equations. Maybe Dr. Oliver Sacks would come from New York City to examine him. Dr. Sacks would watch Dave solve huge mathematical equations on a big blackboard in a university. Maybe they'd make a movie about him, starring Robert Redford. Dave could see himself going to the opening of the movie at the film festival with his only friend in the world, the old Egyptian orderly. And he knew he had to do one thing, and he had to do it fast. He had to kill the fly. Until he killed the fly, he was not going to be able to function as a normal human being. And the only thing he could think of doing was to cut off the fly's supply of oxygen. But there was a problem. This is Dave's supply of oxygen, too. Working on this sort of medical problem, which essentially involves auto surgery, is not something Dave likes to do at home in front of his family. He told Morley he had to go back to work. He was too anxious to eat dinner. He said, "I'm not hungry. I got to go back to work." He let himself into the store and he spent a half an hour squatting on the floor behind the counter, trying to hold his breath for longer than a minute. And that's when Dave realized that the fly probably wanted to get out of there as badly as he wanted it out. When he realized they weren't enemies, when he realized they were partners. This is what people who run management seminars call a shift in paradigms. Dave should help the fly, not punish it. He should show the fly the way home. And he stood in his record store and he looked around and his eyes landed on a table lamp on the counter beside the cash register. And he walked over to the lamp and he removed the shade and he flicked on the light and he opened his mouth as wide as he could. And he began to sink down toward the light bulb with his mouth open, wide, trying to get his lips as close to the bulb as he could. Which is what he was doing when his eyes caught movement at the front door. And he saw his friend Jim Schofield staring at him with his mouth wide open. Wider than Dave's. Dave straightened up and unlocked the front door. "I was just walking by," said Jim. "I didn't mean to look in." I swallowed a fly," said Dave. "It's in my lungs. I thought it might be attracted to the light. I thought it might fly out to the light." "That's moths," said Jim. "What?" said Dave. "Moths," said Jim. It's moths that are attracted to light." Dave stared at his friend. What are flies attracted to, said Dave. There was a long and horrible moment of silence. Jim said, do you have a vacuum cleaner? Dave glanced toward the back of the store. It was a reflex. Jim brightened. He said, we could use the crevice tool, the one for behind the radiator. Dave said, are you out of your mind? And Jim said, we could drown it. We could go to a pool and you could suck in a lung full of water. Dave said, what about me? Jim said, we'll go to the Y where they have lifeguards. They'll know what to do about you. They're trained for that. You look after the fly, they'll look after you. Instead of going to the Y, they went to Horgaff's, humidors, and custom shirts, where Dave bought a $12 cigar. I'll smoke it out, he said. He chose a Cruz Real, number 19, dark and sinister looking, like a burnt stick. When he bought it to the cash register, the man behind the counter seemed to be trying to talk him out of it. That's a little on the strong side, he said. Good, said Dave. Actually, said the man, it has a sort of numbing effect. He lit the cigar on the street and he took a long, deep drag and he held the smoke in his mouth and then he inhaled it. And damn near passed out. Jim stood beside him and said helpful things like, are you all right? And I'm not so sure you're supposed to inhale those things. And then he said, aren't you supposed to drink brandy with those things? It was well after midnight when Dave got home. When he closed his eyes, the room began to spin, so he kept them open and he kept a hand on the floor to steady himself. And that's exactly the position he was in when he woke up at 11 o'clock the next morning, lying on his side with his mouth hanging wide open, his pillow wet from where he'd been drooling. An awful thirst in his mouth. In his entire being, his mouth must have been open all night, and this strange whacking sound he didn't recognize coming from the other side of the room. Morley, he said, without moving, without rolling over. I phoned Brian, said Morley. Brian opened the store. Whack! There it was again. He rolled over. Morley was poised by the window, a rolled newspaper raised in her right hand. There was a fly on the window, walking toward the ceiling. And Morley drew the paper back, and Dave said, wait, stop! Don't kill it. Just open the window. It'll go out by itself. Thank you.